Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Our first guest today is Brooke Mayer, an associate professor of civil construction and environmental engineering at Marquette University's Opus College of Engineering. And we're going to be talking with her about the challenges in phosphorus sustainability. What would you like to know about the problems phosphates can cause to the environment? Maybe you have an experience to share. I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Brooke Mayer, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks so much for having me on, Larry. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So before we talk about phosphorus, maybe you could tell us a little bit more about the areas you focus on as an environmental engineer.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think, you know, as an environmental engineer, I deal with all sorts of different compartments related to the environment. But the biggest one that I work on is related to water quality. And so that can take the form of thinking about drinking water quality, you know, cleaning it up so it's safe when it comes out of your tap to drink. But also, at the same time, that water then goes down the drain. And so my team also focuses on wastewater and thinking about making sure it's clean enough to go back to the environment after we do all sorts of human uses with it. So kind of anything related to water quality, water treatment, and those types of ideas.
And that, of course, extends to our lakes and rivers.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about phosphorus. Maybe first, why do we need phosphorus?
So phosphorus is kind of a really, really interesting element in that if you think of anything that is biological in nature, so whether it's us as humans or if we think about, you know, an apple that maybe you ate at lunch or a bacterial cell, anything that's biological has phosphorus in it, and it has to have phosphorus to function. So cells use phosphorus for all sorts of stuff, like the structure of the cell itself that gives it its form. But also, it's a really important ingredient in DNA, so our nucleic acid that give us the blueprint for life. And it also functions to help energy go through cells. So literally, every cell has to have some amount of phosphorus in it to be able to function. And so, you know, that becomes very important as we think about, for example, supporting global food supply. So making sure that the crops that we're growing have enough phosphorus in them that they can actually grow and that we get a strong enough yield to be able to support the demand for food.
Yeah, and maybe talk about where it comes from.
Yeah, so phosphorus is an interesting thing where there's actually a fair amount of it in the Earth's crust. But what we do for our uses for people, where about 80% of the phosphorus that we use goes to the global food cycle. But the place where we get it from is we literally dig into the Earth to get it. So it's a mining process. So, just like thinking like you would about fossil fuels, we do the same thing with phosphorus. And so we have to mine it at places where it's naturally prevalent. The other interesting part about that is phosphorus supplies, just like fossil fuels, aren't evenly distributed across the world. So there's about 4 countries that hold a little bit over 80% of the world's phosphorus supplies, one of those including the U.S., but the biggest actually being Morocco, and then also China and South Africa. But in those places, we dig it out of the ground, we process it, and then, like I said, about 80% of that goes into fertilizer type of products, with the remainder going into different types of industrial uses, for example, things like phosphoric acid.
Yeah, and the concerns, let's talk about mining. What are the concerns with the way phosphorus is mined?
I think probably the biggest thing that pops into mind is what we were just mentioning with the limited distribution of supply. So just making sure that we can access it, get at it in a cost-effective manner. If we think about it's a limited resource where it's non-renewable over the time frame that we look at for people, we can think about it as kind of a peak demand curve or a peak supply curve. So eventually we need phosphorus and we're not going to have enough supplies. And so it's going to become more expensive to get it out of the ground. And so there's a lot of people and companies who are focused on trying to look at more efficient mining. But then the other side of that is as they go through the production process, just like pretty much anything that we would produce, there's going to be some waste products that come out of that. And so if you were to visit, say, a phosphorus mine, there might be some phosphogypsum leftover stuff, the byproducts of that production. And if those happen to get released into the environment in a non-controlled way, then that can cause some problems. And we actually saw that, I believe, in 2021 in Piney Lake in Florida, where we had some release of the phosphorus gypsum supplies that went to water supplies. And so that also has some things like heavy metals in addition to the phosphorus. And so the waste treatment side of it also comes into play.
And so just as an aside, that I imagine they're looking at ways to deal with that waste treatment and possibly find uses for it.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's a challenge, but anytime you have a challenge, it's an opportunity to do something better. And so by the time you've gone through all that treatment, you can imagine some of those wastes do have a lot of phosphorus in them. And so it's an opportunity to think about how we can actually further extract that phosphorus and get that usable product out of it by separating it out from some of the things that would be damaging, like the heavy metals or the toxic substances. So again, some of the companies who really focus in on this are very interested in technologies where they could kind of extract phosphorus from really a big mess of other stuff and get it in a very pure form so that, again, it can go back into the useful production. And so I think that's something that everybody is really interested in looking at.
Yeah, I would guess so. I read somewhere, now correct me if I'm wrong on this, but those mines, the main mines, were, you know, maybe 100 years, they'll be done?
It's actually a really interesting question because, yeah, you'll read some articles that will predict when we might run out of phosphorus, and you'll find some pretty broad time frames that people report. I think probably the earliest or the shortest time frame that I've seen is about, like you said, 90 to 100 years. Others have reported 300 years. But the truth about it is that it's a question that we can have some educated guesses on, but we don't know exactly because the way that they estimate those are based on the phosphorus reserves that are in the ground, and we never know exactly how much of those reserves are out there. And so when things are uncovered, as geologists are doing different types of surveys, those estimates sometimes increase dramatically, occasionally decrease. But because of that, we're kind of constantly learning about how much phosphorus is out there. And kind of the best, recommendation or suggestion that I've heard and kind of abide by is that we're not necessarily going to run out anytime soon, but we do come up on that supply-demand problem where thinking about the efficiency and economics of extraction is probably going to come into play sooner than literally running out of the amount of phosphorus out there.
You know, when I think about soils in Wisconsin, you know, many of the soils in Wisconsin are already pretty darn full of phosphorus.
Yeah.
Are they not?
Yeah, exactly. If you think about, you know, phosphorus applications, especially in agricultural related areas like we have across a lot of Wisconsin and the Midwest, that phosphorus sometimes get into the soil and it might bind to something. And so it might kind of stick around in there for a while. And people will talk about that as legacy phosphorus. And so that phosphorus can keep accumulating in the soils over time. And because of that, if we have a soil that's high in phosphorus, we might not actually need to apply phosphorus as a fertilizer. We might be focused more on the other nutrients. And so I think when we're talking about agricultural applications of fertilizer, it's really, really important to know what's in the soil to begin with. And so relying on soil tests to figure out the application rates of phosphorus and other nutrients is pretty critical.
Yeah. So, and there are a lot of concerns of using, too much of it in our soils, gets into the water, as you say, and
yeah, if it, you know, as it accumulates in those soils, that legacy phosphorus can be there for a while. But when it's there, it's going to undergo different types of kind of conversion or transformation processes as the chemicals break down and rearrange themselves. And eventually, over time, that phosphorus can leach out, and so it can erode and get into our waterways. And so I think, you know, when you think about how much phosphorus goes into an agricultural system, if you call it, you know, food to fork or farm to fork, you lose, I'll call it, about roughly 40 to 50% of that phosphorus along the way that doesn't make it into our mouths as we're eating these things. And so that phosphorus that's lost, a lot of that goes into things like erosion that get into the waterways. Other parts of it are actually kind of wastes that, you know, after we eat something, whether it's a steak or whatever it might be, a lot of that phosphorus passes through our bodies and is in the wastewater afterwards. And so thinking about how to kind of intercept some of those flows of phosphorus before they can be damaging and too high of levels in the environment becomes important.
Yeah, I would think so. I was thinking about Madison, the city of Madison, that, you know, there are some rules on for homeowners and phosphorus application or fertilizer application. You know, most we really don't need phosphorus for most lawns, for example. So you can buy fertilizers that don't contain it.
Yeah, exactly. Different cities have looked at different approaches to do this, and Madison is a great example. St. Paul, Minnesota, likewise, they put in a phosphorus fertilizer ban probably in the early 2000s. And like you said, you can go to the hardware or wherever you're getting your fertilizer from and look at the bags that you're buying, and they'll have three numbers on them that represent nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. And so that middle number is always phosphorus, but you can buy fertilizers that have a big zero in the middle and mean that they don't have phosphorus because we don't necessarily have to apply it to soils that already have a high enough concentration.
Yeah. Brooke Mayer, our guest today, she is an associate professor of civil construction and environmental engineering in Marquette University's Opus College of Engineering, talking with her about phosphorus. And I hope you'll join in with your questions. I haven't given the number since we started, so let me give it right now. It's 1-800-642-1234. Question or comment for her? I hope you join in. 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us, the email address, ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. Jill Nadeau, our producer today, Tyler Dinner, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Taking a look at phosphorus today on the show, finding a more sustainable future with it. Our guest, Brooke Mayer, associate professor of civil construction and environmental engineering in Marquette University's Opus College of Engineering. Questions for her? Again, you can join in at 800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. And let's take a call. Scott in Madison, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Good morning. I worked in a hardware store and was addressed by a customer who needed phosphorus for his lawn. I asked very politely if he was starting a new lawn. And he goes, "Oh, no, I'm trying to keep up with the lawn across the way." I ask again very politely, "Who are you trying to keep up with? I hope you don't live within our lake drainage system." And he goes, "Oh, no, nothing to worry about. This won't get in the lake. I live on Door Creek."
Comment on that, Brooke?
Yeah, I'm laughing along with you because I love that you brought up the question to him. You know, what is the state of the lawn that you're looking at? If you're just starting off brand new, like you said, yeah, maybe some inputs of phosphorus are going to help out. But with those established ones, it is always interesting to think about everybody trying to keep up with their neighbors and also not recognizing, you know, that the creek is just as at risk as thinking about the lakes and everything around. So I love that you brought up with established lawns, thinking about really what is the soil condition to start off in it and giving some critical thought to that before applying any sort of fertilizer.
Yeah, and Door Creek runs right into a lake. So there you go. So, and you can probably describe this. There may be people who aren't familiar with it. What happens when phosphorus leaches into the waterways like that?
Yeah. So, like we were talking about earlier, phosphorus is this essential thing. So enough of it is a great thing. It's kind of like the Goldilocks scenario, right? You want just the right amount. But if you get too much of it, it causes overgrowth of different types of organisms. So if you imagine it was Door Creek, or if you imagine it's Lake Michigan, and you get too much phosphorus out there, it causes different types of bacteria and algae just to take off and grow like crazy. And they produce those, a lot of times bright green algae blooms that you see in the summertime. Which maybe they look kind of cool, but they're really not very good things because as those cells grow, they use up oxygen out of the system. And especially as they grow and die off, if they use too much oxygen, then the levels drop below what's healthy for an aquatic system. And so some of the organisms that are in there can't survive as those oxygen levels drop. And so in the very worst case, you could actually see things like fish kills on the shores. And beyond that, there's certain types of these bacterial cells that actually can produce toxins. And so those toxins are really bad for organisms. And so they can make people sick. If we recall back to about 2014, they actually shut down the drinking water system in Ohio, in parts of Ohio off of Lake Erie, because they had these toxins in them. And similarly, in Wisconsin, occasionally we'll have warnings where, don't let your dog swim in this water body because we have these toxic producing organisms. And so, yeah, too much of a good thing is also not a good thing.
Yeah. Well, you recently partnered with, I believe, a number of institutions to find more sustainable practices with phosphorus. Who are you working with, and what are the goals?
Yeah, so it's a really cool collaboration where Marquette is working with 7 other institutions across the United States. And so those include schools in Arizona and Florida and Illinois, as well as North Carolina, which is our lead institution, is North Carolina State University. But what's really unique about it is it brings together people who have expertise in phosphorus from all different disciplines and perspectives. From kind of the atomic side of things and thinking about just the element of phosphorus and how it, behaves or transforms or attaches to things, all the way up to people looking at the global scale. So how do phosphorus economics happen across the globe as we look at imports and exports, for example? Or how does phosphorus behave when it gets onto an agricultural field, whether it's a crop-based system like corn, or if we're using it for like an animal-based system, what happens to that phosphorus? So, we counted up at one point, and I think we have about 26 different disciplines of people who all come at phosphorus from a different angle, which is really unique to think about it from all those points of view. And we also mapped it out. We're covering about 17 orders of magnitude and length scale, from that atomistic scale all the way up to the global scale, and thinking about how phosphorus behaves and how we make sure that as a people that we're using it sustainably in that sort of manner.
And within those levels, what part does Marquette play in the initiative?
Yeah, so right now our main focus has been kind of at the material scale, so the smaller end of things. So some of the things, for example, that we're working at as part of the center include designing materials that can selectively grab phosphorus out of a complex matrix, whether that's an environmental water or a wastewater where there's lots of other stuff floating around. But we want to grab it out and stick it to something. And then after we stick it to it, so it removes out of the water and preserves that water quality, we want to be able to get it back off so that we could use that as a fertilizer source. So it's kind of a circular economy where we're looking at waste to resource. And one of the materials that we've been looking at doing this is actually taking a clue from nature. And so, all cells use this phosphorus, so they have really cool ways of grabbing it. And so different types of bacteria have proteins that can grab that phosphorus. And so we're actually taking advantage of, millions of years of these bacteria figuring out a very effective way to do it. And we're using those proteins to grab the phosphorus and then recover it in a controlled setting so that we can reuse it in the system where it was actually waste previously.
That's very cool. Are you making any progress on that?
We are. It's pretty exciting because it's you know, pretty early stage research, but we've shown that we can, you know, grab this phosphorus, extract it, and purify it with that protein that we take out of, for example, E. coli cells. And then we can, you know, attach that phosphorus, kind of like gluing it onto a little marble, and then pass water through it. And we can extract that phosphorus really, really well, where we don't get any interference from all the other junk that's in water. You know, I'll throw out one example. Arsenate. If there's arsenic in a water, we know that's a bad thing for people's health, but it's also very similarly structured to a phosphate molecule. And so these proteins can actually differentiate between the two, which almost no other material can do. And so we get a very, very pure phosphorus product back in the end, which is great for that circular economy point of view.
Yeah. Steve in Stoughton, we'll give you a chance. Thanks for joining in. What's on your mind?
Hey, good morning. You kind of touched on the treatment side of things. I was just curious that it seems like we always, whenever like the EPA or the DNR introduces a lower water quality standard, we have industry groups challenging, you know, whether that's achievable or not. So what are the barriers currently to treatment systems like our POTWs to achieve lower standards without, you know, getting into the maybe the details of the research that you're doing. But what currently are the barriers?
Yeah, it's a really great point, Steve. I mean, if we think about Wisconsin and potentially decreasing levels of phosphorus discharges that are allowable, historic levels have kind of targeted a 1 milligram per liter phosphorus level that's acceptable. But in some of our very sensitive water bodies, that's reducing orders of magnitude. And so the technologies that people use to get at that phosphorus are limited on a very fundamental basis. So, you know, if you think back to those strange, scary words that we talked about at school at one point of things like thermodynamics, they're actually limited by how well they can stick things onto other things and how organisms can uptake them. And so it takes some additional work in looking at those materials to try to overcome those kind of fundamental scientific barriers.
So, a lot of work to do.
Yeah, a lot of work to do, but, you know, like we were saying, anytime you have a challenge, it's a tremendous opportunity. And so I think there's a lot of good work that can be done to really think about the sustainable side of those.
Well, you know, you work at Marquette, and I've got to believe you've got a lot of students involved in this being Marquette.
Yeah, absolutely. Students are always at the heart of our mission. And so, you know, if we're thinking about this this center that we were just talking about that involves, you know, all the eight institutions, at Marquette we have two graduate students who are working full-time on thinking about this attachment and conversion type of systems. But we also have undergraduates who get engaged every year on this. And across our whole system, we have about 40 students who are conducting research on different aspects and from different disciplines to really target in on that phosphorus sustainability question. And I would add that I think that is essential because, you know, related to our last question, we have status quo technology or what our system is right now. But if we want to do better in the future, and one of our targets is, you know, 25 years down the road, can we have big reductions in dependence on mined phosphorus as well as those losses to surface waters? If we want to do that, we have to rely on these future professionals that are coming out, that are being trained and are excited to go out and really make a difference in this field.
Let's take another call. Al in Abrams, your turn. Hi, Al.
Hi. I've got a question for your guest regarding egg runoff. And it seems to me here in northeastern Wisconsin that there's less attention paid to soil erosion, nutrient management plans, water quality in general than there was, say, 40 years ago. I worked in the profession for a long time. And, you know, in the 80s, we had priority watersheds. We had grass waterways. We had all sorts of things to try and curtail ag runoff. And now they're plowing through the grass waterways, and I've just noticed a dramatic decrease in water quality, at least in this part of the state.
Hmm. Al, thanks for calling. Comment, Brooke.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point that you bring up, because I would probably think in my own mind, and I haven't been in Wisconsin for the last 40 years, but that we would actually have more attention that's being paid right now. So it's interesting that you brought that up. But when I think about agricultural industry, as you well know, that one is harder to control, that phosphorus in the runoff, because it's so diffuse. And so if we think about it being applied on a field, or if it's used at a dairy or something like that, that's a lot harder to capture that phosphorus and avoid the detrimental outcomes when it's released in the environment than something like an urban center. But because of that, there's a lot of work that's going on things like best management practices from all points of view. So thinking about the stormwater that's coming off of fields with buffer strips, with any sort of different type of green infrastructure that's out there, I think there's been a real emphasis on that. And a lot of that has come maybe from a top-down point of view of thinking about regulations for how much nutrient loading can go into the water body, but also bottom-up of people saying, hey, we don't want this to go in here. We can see the negative impacts. So to Al's point, I think it's interesting to think about how this changes over time. My sincere hope would be that we're going to be paying a lot of attention to it in these coming years, because as we pointed out, it's something that's not going away. It's going to continue to be an issue. And I think that we're learning more about effective approaches to be able to handle that, specifically for those diffuse sources of emission like agricultural runoff.
Yeah. It's very complex issue for sure. And I know, a lot of the phosphorus in the soil, I think the legacy phosphorus, it's not possible. I mean, plants have adapted over time to be able to use that that phosphorus. But our crop plants, I was reading a story about this, Jill Nadeau passed it on to me, those plants, the ones that we, the corn or whatever we put in the ground, aren't adapted to using this legacy phosphorus you mentioned earlier. And so there's, I guess, research going on with plants.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a huge critical part of thinking about that entire sustainability problem. I do work more on the water end of things, but there are a lot of people who are looking specifically at the plants, at the agriculture that's going on. And I'll just offer one example of that. With the research center that I'm with working on phosphorus sustainability, there's a handful of researchers at North Carolina State who are looking specifically at corn as a good example, because we grow so much of it, and thinking about the actual functioning of how corn takes up phosphorus. And so just like you're saying, Larry, they're thinking about, can they work with this corn and maybe hybridize it so that it can uptake phosphorus better from soil, especially some of that phosphorus that's really locked in, and people talk about it as not being bioavailable. So it gets stuck in there until it slowly releases over time. But there are ways of modifying and kind of growing different sorts of species of these plants that can do a better job of not only uptaking it, but then also utilizing it within their own cells. So thinking about it as phosphorus use efficiency, so that the plants can do a better job at really accessing those pools that are, out there and ready to dig into that we want to take advantage of.
Yeah, I was reading the root systems of other plants that are not crop plants, let's put it that way, are finer and are more capable of uptaking phosphorus, and that's something that I guess we need to be thinking about in terms of corn and other crops like it.
Yeah, I totally agree. And from my own kind of limited knowledge of this, also, when we think about those root systems, you know, it's not just the plant itself that we're interested in, but the microbial community that it helps to encourage grow, right? And so thinking about the bacteria and the fungus and how they all work together symbiotically to break down that phosphorus and access it.
Yeah, so we might be down the road sometime applying fungi or whatever along with the plant itself.
Yeah, it's actually a really interesting point, because one of the other things that we're working on as part of the center with some other researchers is how phosphorus transforms when it's out in the environment. So plants and cells usually take up one specific form of it, but if it's not in that form and, you know, it's locked in soil or it's a big complex organic, that's going to shift over time. And it happens because of biological reactions like you're talking about, or chemical reactions. And so thinking of how quickly those happen and how to stimulate those things, I think will really advance what you're talking about of accessing those kind of locked away pools of phosphorus.
Steve in Wausau, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Just very interested in the show, but I'm not a farmer or anything like that, but I notice in Marathon County where I live, we have a great deal of ginseng growing here, and it's my understanding you can't grow it on the same piece of ground twice.
Yeah.
Is there any way that they could harvest the ginseng, but and maybe take 5 cents a pound or something like that, put that towards research and see how they could do it again?
The problem with it is, Brooke, are you familiar with that?
You know, I honestly don't know much about that other than thinking about the rotation of crops to make sure that you have efficient nutrient uptake.
Well, yeah, with ginseng, the plant itself produces a chemical in its roots that actually will poison any other attempt to put new ginseng plants in that same soil. And so I guess if you were going to figure out a way to do it, you'd have to figure out a way to plant, to have ginseng that would not be releasing that chemical into the soil. And boy, that's a very basic explanation. And probably some ginseng farmer somewhere is going to call and say, what the heck were you talking about? But that, I think that is basically what's going on with that. And the ginseng growers and this is all kind of off topic a little bit, but the ginseng growers do have a research fund arm that is working on a number of things. I don't know if it's working on that or not, but certainly working on research to help ginseng. So the water, your main concern is the water, Brooke, and I really love your idea about nabbing the phosphorus out of water. I mean, can you envision a time when, you know, we go into, Lake Mendota in Madison and be able to pull the phosphorus out of it?
You know, I think it's a really big challenge, but it's something that is on our agenda to look at. And, you know, when we think about Lake Mendota or other relatively large water bodies that people are working on this issue, one of the things that is sometimes done is essentially to kind of add a chemical into that system that grabs the phosphorus. But what it ends up doing typically in the form that they use it right now is it attaches phosphorus to something like an aluminum molecule and grabs it, and it settles to the bottom of that lake. And so it's kind of a sequestration where you're getting it out of the water, which helps with immediate water quality. But the other side of that is that phosphorus doesn't leave that system, right? It just keeps piling up. And so, again, kind of contributes to that legacy phosphorus issue. And over time, you're still going to have chemical reactions that are going on. And if, for example, if the amount of oxygen changes in that system, it can potentially trigger releases of that phosphorus. And so I do think that long term, what we'd really like to do is not just simply sequester that phosphorus at the bottom of a lake, but really attach it to something that we can extract back out of the system to put back into productive use. And so I think that it's a tough challenge because those are such big water bodies, but I do think that that is what we're aiming to do, is really, you know, have that water or the phosphorus in the water stick onto something that we can extract out and reuse.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a good way to go. Well, what's your timeline on this? What's your research? Typically, there's a funding threshold and so forth, a time threshold.
Yeah, so my research group itself has been working on phosphorus for pretty much as long as I got started up. And then that led us into working with this collaboration across the other institutions. And with that particular funding cycle, we were funded initially for 5 years, and it started last year in 2021 at a level that was pretty high, a $25 million investment to really, you know, dig into this tremendous phosphorus challenge. And we expect that that's going to continue on 5 years after that. And so with that particular collaboration, we'd be looking at a 10-year cycle where we can perform some of that really fundamental research that's needed to advance some of the larger scale systems and applications. And that's where, you know, after 10 years, we're really looking long term. In 25 years, how does that investment in the fundamental research bring back returns in the actual applications on the farm fields or in the dairies or even in the ginseng fields?
That's very well put. And maybe if we're around 5 or 10 years from now, we need to talk about this again. I'll certainly look forward to hearing progress that you folks are making at Marquette, and would love to have a chance to learn more about it as you move along. So thank you. In the meantime, thanks a lot for being with us, Brooke. I really appreciate your time and your talent.
Thank you so much. It was a true pleasure to visit with you today.
Brooke Mayer is an associate professor of civil construction and environmental engineering at Marquette University's Opus College of Engineering. That's some really cool research, isn't it? I love that they're working on this. And, of course, phosphorus gets into our waters, including our Great Lakes. That could be one of the problems that we'll be talking about next as we visit about fisheries in the Great Lakes. They're under a stress from a lot of areas, and we'll learn about those areas and what's being done to ameliorate it with our next guest. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network.